Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, one and all, my true crime darling angels. How are you tonight? My name is Tricia, and this is Web Sleuths Radio, and that is, of course, in connection with, if I do say so myself, the very best true crime discussion forum on the internet. That would be websleuths.com. In a little bit, we're going to talk to Susan Winter's niece. Susan Winter's was murdered by drinking antifreeze. This case will blow your mind. But first, I'd like to welcome our first guest, Pete Klismet. Now, you've heard of Pete. He is a former FBI profiler, criminal profiler. He's done everything. 4 years on a submarine with two tours of Vietnam. He works for the Ventura Police Department, bachelor's, master's. He's won awards, plus he's an author. And guess what? He's with us right now on True Crime Radio. And Pete, sorry, that was my old title, Web Sleuths Radio. Pete, welcome to Web Sleuths Radio.
Thank you, Tricia. Glad to be here.
Good.
I am.
Good. Okay.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be here.
I am delighted that you're here because we have so much I want to get to. But first, let's talk about one of your books, and then we're going to get into some cases. Pete, you have a book called Homegrown Terror, and I just tell us about it. It is fascinating, incredible, and tell us why you wrote it. How did you get to that point of writing the book, and tell us about the book?
Well, the real name actually is FBI Diary, Homegrown Terror. I intend to do more in the FBI Diary series of books, but the Homegrown Terror book arises out of an incident that occurred down in the Four Corners area back in 1998. Where three anti-government, paramilitary, I guess, camouflage-wearing, gun-toting guys hijacked, or rather stole, a large water truck and were taking it somewhere to do something with it. And I think I know what that is. I'll wait. But in any event, they were noticed by a police officer in Cortez, Colorado, and so they pulled over without even him putting on his lights. The passenger, there were three men in the thing, and they were all young men, under 25. Mm-hmm. The passenger jumped out, raced around to the back, and immediately opened fire on the police car with a semi-automatic, or it may have been converted to full automatic rifle. There were, I don't remember how many shots fired into that car, but whatever the capabilities of the magazine of that rifle were, then he emptied it out, so it's probably around 40. It killed Officer Claxton, obviously. He went back to the car, jumped in. Citizens stopped, saw, called the police. The vehicle they're driving is a big, honking old water truck. It's about 20 feet long or maybe more than that. Then is taking off. And, of course, this thing would not be confused with an Indianapolis Speedway racing vehicle. And so it's lumbering, I guess, down the road, and they're trying to find it. And they pull up on a hillside area where they see a truck. It's a flatbed, and they decide they're going to hijack that and do. Mm-hmm. And they throw all their weapons on there. They throw all of their ammunition on there, and away they go. Now,
so wait, stop 1 second. So they hijacked that flatbed truck, right?
Yep.
Is that what you're saying? Okay. So
yes.
They hijack. Okay. I just want to make clear here. So we got the train of thought going here. So they've hijacked that flatbed truck. Okay. Please continue.
They hijacked that and they left that big old water truck sitting there. And then so they pull out of the driveway. Lo and behold, one of the officers that had been in the area looking for that big water truck was coming right down the street, and they pulled in right in back of him. Jason Bisch, a deputy from Montezuma County, and one of these guys was leaning over the hood of the truck. The other two guys were, one was driving and one was passengering, and had broken out the front window, and they start shooting at Jason Bishop. As luck would have it, one round hit in the back of the truck, or his patrol car, rather, and splintered off, but one piece hit him in the head, knocked him out cold, and he crashed into a house. They took off and continued shooting. It was an unimaginable shooting. Number of police cars that were put out of commission. It was like a carnival. Police car pops up, commission. They got an AK-47. They got a M16A1 shooting 223 rounds. And so they wound up putting a total of 7 police cars out of commission in this chase.
Oh, dear. Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, then they take off. They go out to a national park out there. It's Hovenweep National Park. And as they're pulling in, they see the park ranger, and he's in his ranger vehicle. And he knows that they're coming, or he knows there's a possibility they're coming. And so he lays down in the front seat of the car, and he starts shooting. Or they start shooting, I should say. He didn't have a weapon. And as luck would have it, he wasn't hit, but they killed another police car. And so they go out into the park. They know the whole area. And then the chase, I guess, officially starts at that point. This thing was broadcast kind of like, if you remember the Boston shootings with the marathon. Yeah.
Yes, the Boston bomber, right.
Yeah, the Boston bomber. Yeah, it wasn't a shooting. It was a bomb. Well, it eventually became a shooting. But,
became a shooting, right.
But in any event, this thing became the largest manhunt in the history of the West, and I believe still remains the largest manhunt. All three of these guys get out of the truck, and away they go out into the desert, and this is some forbidden land in this part of the world. If anybody is familiar with Four Corners, they know exactly what I'm talking about. It's really desolate. Hot, desolate, nasty, and throw in the occasional snake, which will bite you. And off they go. They split up, it appears, and they get officers out there a couple of hours later because they lost the truck. They didn't know where it was, and they finally found it from the air. And chase is on. And these guys are in territory where you could hide. I mean, the rocks and boulders and nooks and crannies, they're so big, some of the boulders jut out enough that you could hide the entire Denver Bronco football team underneath.
Oh, jeez.
So it is really about the worst possible place you could conduct a search for three men who will kill you. Well, they had already killed one officer. They put two out of commission. They shot two other officers. Ultimately, there was a deputy from Utah that they shot. So they had four people down, one dead, seriously injured. And the search for these guys continued for weeks and weeks, but eventually people had to pull some of their personnel back in. And
so
they didn't
find, you're saying... What? I want to stop you here. So you're saying they didn't find them that day? They didn't find them? Oh, my God. Okay. Keep going.
No. Not even close. No. Not a chance. And they had eventually 500 total people out there searching to find them. And they found two of them, but they were both dead.
Dead, right.
They both had shot themselves, or one had shot the other, and then he'd shot himself. And the search for the third one went on for about 9 years. And that's kind of the end of the book. That's the culmination of the book, how that all came about and how it ended. I think provides a little drama, and I don't necessarily want to give that away. So.
Oh, no, I can't give it away. Oh, that sounds like a great book. And I remember that happening, but I don't remember the end. So that Homegrown Evil, and that's from the FBI Diaries. FBI Diaries, Homegrown Evil, right?
No. Homegrown Terror.
Homegrown Terror. Sorry, I got Profiles of Evil. I wasn't looking at my notes. FBI Diary, Homegrown Terror, and there's also a book called FBI Diary, Profiles of Evil that we'll get into in just a little bit. My apologies for mixing those two titles up. Now,
Well,
I shouldn't. I need to be perfect here, and I'm sure I'm going to get yelled at by the boss, but that's okay because I'm the boss. Anyway, let's get back to what you do, and that is you give great information about current cases. And there is one here that, well, before I say that, you have commented on the Dylan Redwine case. And I know a lot of people are on the edge of their seats right now going, tell us about Dylan, tell us about Mark Redwine. You cannot because you have a gag order. So Pete Klismet, everybody, he wants to talk. He can't. We don't want to see him in jail because we like talking to him from out of the bars, not behind the bars. So that's why you can't talk about Dylan, right?
Yeah, that's it.
I'm
far more useful when I'm not in jail. So
that's true. I've heard that.
Yeah. The district attorney has told all of the people that were involved in that investigation, and I was, as a lot of you listeners probably know, to not say anything to the press, any mass media or anything, because they don't want to have any wrongful influence on the prosecution of the case. I've got to respect that. When they first arrested me, my phone blew up. And I was getting calls at that point. You know, I wasn't expecting, I didn't know they had a, oh, they didn't have a restriction on talking at that point, but eventually.
No, they didn't.
No.
It was after. So that's why, people. So don't think I'm being derelict in my duties here. There is a very good reason why Mr. Klismet cannot talk about the Dylan Redwine case. We can talk about everything else. And one of the cases that has really captured everybody is Michelle Carter. I'm sorry. This young lady just seems like a monster. She is the one that kept texting her boyfriend, telling him to get it over with, kill yourself, basically just humiliating him into killing himself. I do not think for one second he would have killed himself if she hadn't been there texting. Now, she was charged, and she was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter and sentenced to 15 months. And her boyfriend's family, boyfriend is Conrad Roy, the Roy family, they're suing her. What in the world? I've never heard of anybody doing anything this cruel. And Pete Klismet, you know the cruel mind of people out there. Explain this to me. Who is Michelle Carter and what the hell was going on?
Well, Michelle Carter is a young lady, I think, that probably has some very sadistic tendencies, but she's also got some serious mental health problems and perhaps was not capable of really controlling herself. Now, in saying that, I'm not making any excuse for her, because the behavior is inexcusable. But I think what she did is realized that he was a vulnerable guy and she could kind of play God, in a sense, and lead him around by his nose. And, you know, you women, with all due respect, and I do believe this, it took me about 50 years to learn this, but...
I'm ready.
Women are smarter than men.
Thank you.
You have some intuition. And it took me a long, long time. I guess I've got kind of a flat learning curve, but I got that figured out.
Good. I didn't mean to interrupt. He was very depressed. Is that what you're going to say?
He was very depressed. And how do I know this? Well, I watched this, as luck would have it, just the other night on 2020. And like other people in the country, you know, read about it and thought, man, what a crazy thing this is. And it's, in a sense, it's kind of my job to follow things like this, I guess, self-imposed. But, you know, they never really had a relationship, if I recall correctly. They never really went out. They had kind of an electronic relationship. You know, they text each other a lot. And, you know, I don't know if he ever hugged her.
Oh, dear.
But in any event, you know, like a lot of women, I suppose she may have been a bit of a caretaker. I don't know. I mean, she knows he wants to commit suicide, and he's talked about it so much. You know, is she trying initially to talk him out of it, or is she trying what is she trying to do? Is she trying to help him, save him, or what? Finally, this thing progresses for, I'm going to say 2 years, but I don't know if that's how long it went on, but I think that's close to right. And she, I think, had heard this enough that I think the answer to why it happened and why she wanted him to do what he did was to rid herself of a problem. I mean, this whole
thing. So she was just sick of, she was like sick of it, is what you're saying, and tired of him talking about it, so she convinces him to do it?
Yeah. I mean, I watch these things with kind of a, I would say a selective eye. You know, there's, I look at these differently than most people do. And there's some things I got out of watching 2020 the other night, and seeing her and just the whole combination of things caused me to think that was probably her motive. You know, I've heard this stuff for 2 years. Give me a break. Go ahead and do it. If that makes sense. And you know, I was sitting there watching it, trying to figure out what makes sense, you know, and had a meeting with my about that, and finally decided, that's what makes sense to me. So that may not be right, but it made sense.
Now, right, and that's go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I was almost blown away by the prosecution's theory on this. That, you know, in fact, I thought it was stupid. How could they come up with something like this? Because they said they believe she did it, and that was their final argument, because it would make her more popular at school, and her friends and other people would be drawn closer to her because they'd feel sorry for her, and as a consequence, she'd gain in status. And that's what the prosecution argued. Wait a minute. Why make it that complicated? I mean, that's unrealistic, I think. So, you know, why, I don't know why these things happen. I mean, it happened with our Columbine shooters here. It happens all the time. You know, how can the family not see any of these red flags? I mean, there's signs that were flying all over the place. You know,
right.
Red, if not hurricane warning flags, you know, flying all over. And why, you know, why did not the parents of her or him, either one, take your pick, say or do something? So that's
interesting. And you know what? That's kind of the first full-out description of that theory that I have heard. Basically, I'm fed up. Go ahead and do it. I'm sick of it.
Yeah.
And that does make sense. But it was the cruelty. It was the cruelty of it. You know, get back in the car and calling him names. And I'm going to put you on the spot here because you haven't examined Michelle Carter. We're talking with Peter Kliznet, former FBI profiler, all-around law enforcement guy who does pretty much everything you can think of. Also writes books. We're going to get more from those books in just a moment. But we're talking about the Michelle Carter case, the texting case, pushing her boyfriend to suicide. Think about Michelle Carter and the actual texts that were pretty awful.
Yeah.
What is it in her? Is that, to me, that's what didn't seem normal to me. That does make sense. She's sick of it. I'm tired of it. Do what you want.
Yeah.
You would almost think she would just say that and then cut communication. But it just seemed like there was some sort of, like, power thing going on here with her. And she just became so cruel. Don't you think that is a sign of something deeply wrong with this young lady?
Well, there's no question in my mind that there's something deeply wrong for some, you know, for someone to do something like this. I mean, that's just, I don't know. I don't know that I've ever heard about anybody talking somebody else into committing suicide, although I'm sure it's happened. But anything like this, I mean, using this, just using technology, so you look at your cell phone and a gal that's ostensibly your girlfriend says, well, you better go ahead and do it and get back in that car. You know,
right.
But that caused me, no, but both of them are very vulnerable, well, certainly he is, very vulnerable and very weak personalities. Years ago, we used the DSM-3 and 4. We used to call them inadequate personalities. That has since done away with now, and I think they would be calling these folks, and I'm not a psychologist, so if anybody listening thinks I'm not. I got a whole bunch of degrees and stuff, but none of them are in psychology. So in any event, I think their personalities really led them down the path that they did, and they were together, such as it was, because it's kind of a birds of a feather thing. And they were hanging on, clinging on to each other like a thread. And I think she just put him in such a position that he was a very desperate guy to have, you know, her approval that he went ahead and did it. Now, that sounds stupid to me.
Right.
I mean,
it does.
My theory on that sounds stupid, presumably meaning I'm stupid, but...
No,
Sometimes I
want to back up. I didn't think what you were saying was stupid. I thought what he was – anyway, I didn't mean that, but please continue.
No, I know, but I mean I was calling myself stupid because of
– so,
in any event, I think you've got to – you know, again, what we would call probably borderline personalities. Some serious mental health problems themselves, and I'm not saying they're mentally ill, they're insane or anything. No, they're not. They're functional. Well, if functional, she wouldn't be found guilty, you know.
Right.
In fact, listening to the court said that during the sentencing, that I don't find that you are mentally ill. But you certainly have some mental problems.
Definitely, and I would be curious. Again, and I always harp on this, and I'm not saying it's the parents' fault, blame the parents, but I'm always curious when something horrific is done, especially by a younger person, to see what happened to them in their childhood. And again, not trying to blame the parents, maybe, you know, all kinds of things. Maybe she had been molested. Maybe somebody else was cruel to her and her parents didn't know. To me, there has to be some sort of events or events that led up to this personality that could do something this cruel. And that, again, that's why I always go back and say we have to prevent the creation of these monsters to stop these horrible crimes like this. So do you have a prediction of how she'll do when she's out of prison? Do you think she'll reoffend? Any ideas?
Well, let me go back a second. We'll digress here for a second because as you were saying that there may have been some critical event that caused her to be the way she is. And that's not really true.
No?
I'm sorry?
I said, oh.
Oh, okay. I'm writing a book right now, which is ultimately going to be a college and university textbook. And one of the things that we go into in that book is that the development of a personality of someone – of any of us, is a process. It takes a long time. And even things like abuse in the family. I don't know what her background is. Was there any of that? I don't My guess is probably not. My guess is that because of her own personality traits, she had some very poor self-esteem. She was placed into a mental institution for a period of time. That creates a stigma, if that's known, because you're going to get bullied. And when you get bullied, guess what? If you're bullied, then you don't have control. Okay, so now let's interpose that on this situation. Does she have control over him? Does her intuition show, clearly demonstrates, that she has that control and she can cause him to do whatever she wants him to do. Like a puppet in her hand. And so that's probably more, more correctly of what I think. Then the other, the actual question you asked was, how is she going to do? That's really hard to say. Simply because she is going to, the stigma that she's got after the 15 months that she serves is not going away. I mean, when she gets, the press will be all over her. And consequently, she'll be a media event for a while. Well, you know, what do you do? I mean, she's going to practically have to hide in her basement and just, not be out in public, and yet she'll have the press out in front of her house. It'll take her a long time to recover from this, if ever. So.
Exactly. Well, we'll definitely watch for that, because we all know the other thing that happens when people get out of prison is the tabloids are there flashing money. And I would not be surprised to see a tabloid interview with this young lady, but definitely one of the most disturbing cases we have yet to see, just because of the manner, how it all went down. It all involved new technology and just the cruelty of it. But we're talking with Peter Klizmet, and Peter, you're a former FBI profiler. You've been in law enforcement for years and years. You've written many books. Now, one of the books that you have written, FBI Diary, Profiles of Evil, and you were telling me about a case. And it was, you did a profile, and they totally ignored you. I mean, it's just down the light. They just went, yeah, sure, Pete. What happened was, you were right. You were right all along. And I want to hear the details of this, because it is just amazing. So what? Tell us about this case in Profiles of Evil.
Well, let me just preface that by saying the whole concept of criminal profiling, it was actually called psychological profiling back then, was a relatively new thing on the landscape. And I had been one of the original group that went back, was brought back to Quantico, handpicked and brought back to Quantico for our initial training, which I call profiling boot camp. And it was a couple of weeks involving some of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. Slides and pictures and you name it, and stories and videos of crime scenes with horrible things done to people. Okay, so there was no end to what they exposed us to. In fact, during that first week of the 2 weeks, we had four or five guys that just said, I can't take this, I'm going home. And then on the Friday of the first week, we had a bunch of guys that came into my room, and we sat down, we had a little meeting, and we said, do you guys, is this stuff bothering you as much as it is me? You know, I said that, and everybody said, yeah, it really is. So we really got a snoot full of everything they could throw at us. So what the book does is it just takes an ordinary garden variety agent that was working in a resident agency in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and that would be me, and goes through a variety of different cases I was working on at that point, just, normal cases, and different things I had to do, and then all of a sudden they picked me to be profiling coordinator for the entire division, and then I go back for that training. Now, The second part of that is there has never been a book written that actually takes the reader inside the what was then called the behavioral science unit. I don't even know what it's called anymore, but takes the reader inside the behavioral science unit, takes the reader inside the classes, listens to the lectures, because I've got voluminous notes. And so I've recorded a lot of that, a lot of the different stories that we heard in our initial training. Nobody has ever done that.
Mm-hmm.
What was the training all about? I mean, you didn't walk in and they took a cross and put it on your head and you genuflected and...
and that was it.
Yeah, gave you the imprimatur and you were a profiler. So, and not only that, we also had to go back for more fun twice a year, okay, and just get updated on current cases that were happening. So the initial part of the book, I'll say the first half, is really involved with, you know, what did I do as an agent running around? Because nobody really knows what an FBI agent does. 99% of the people have no clue. And I'm not sure if I did half the time, but I did pretty well. Then it goes into the training back at the academy. And then once you get out, you've got this training, what do you do with the training? See, so, and I started getting some requests, you know, from different agencies to profile cases. And actually, we weren't supposed to do it. But like where I was, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, you may have never heard of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It's out on the eastern side of Iowa, and we had the whole eastern side, and there were quite a number of cities there, and mostly small cities, and mostly in those small cities, their officers are much less experienced with this type of thing because they don't have these types of serious violent crimes. Or very rarely have them. So anyhow, that's, you know, kind of a preface to what we were leading up to here. And what if call it the Beatrice, Beatrice, six case. Beatrice is a little town, 20,000 people, soaking wet, about 50 miles south of Lincoln, Nebraska. I was called by my assistant special agent in charge at home one night, and he said, Pete, I need you to go out to Beatrice, Nebraska. What's Beatrice, Nebraska, John? And he said, it's a town south there, and he explains this to me. Said, well, what do you need me to go there for? He said, well, they've got a homicide, a murder of a 68-year-old woman, and they can't solve it. How long ago did this happen? Oh, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago, I guess. Then they'd run out of leads. They were not a large agency. They didn't have the experience to handle a case like this, okay, period. And not that I'm a homicide expert, but I did investigate several when I was on the police department. So, and I had my training, you know, in profiling at the time. So I said, okay, well, I can't get out there for several days because I got to do this and this and this and this. And he said, that's fine. Just get out there whenever you can, but give him a call. Okay, fine. So I got out there. It was probably 6 o'clock one night, and I met them where they wanted me to meet them at a diner. And so the first thing, you know, they did is they started telling me about what happened with the case. I met with the chief. I met with two detectives. And they started telling me, you know, what had happened. This 68-year-old woman was found by her brother-in-law in her apartment, second-floor apartment, right on the main street there in Beatrice, and was found dead. And, okay, so how did she die? Well, she was suffocated. Okay, fine. And they started telling me, one of them started saying, "And we got a suspect in this case. And let me tell you about the suspect." And I said, "No, wait a minute. Time out. 5-yard penalty on you for illegal procedure. Don't tell me about your suspect, please. Because what my job is to take the reports that you've got, the pictures you've got, everything you've got, and look at it and tell you what I think the suspect looks like. I can't give you his name, rank, and horsepower, but I can tell you, hopefully I can tell you, I don't ever really know until I look, the facts, something about the suspect, the behavioral signs that I see at the crime scene or elsewhere will give me those kind of clues. So in any event, I take the reports and, you know, I tell them, go ahead, why don't you guys go ahead and take off because I'm going to be midnight oil tonight, you know. I don't know how long I'll be looking at these reports. Okay. Away they go. And I'm going through the reports and then I'm seeing a suspect or someone that had done the same type of thing over the course of about a year and a half with some older ladies and gotten into their house and attempted to sexually assault them, and neither or in none of the three cases did it work for several reasons. So but on this occasion it did work. He was able to successfully get into her apartment. He sexually assaulted her, and I knew that he had spent quite a bit of time inside the apartment. I could tell that. Okay, behaviorally told me something, but what would you think that might tell me, that he spent a lot of time there?
That he was comfortable there?
Yep, and why?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know, teacher. Don't dock me from the test, please, because I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. Unless he knew her. He knew her, and she let him in, and he was comfortable there. Could that be possibly it?
Exactly right, Tricia. Now, the knowing her part, I'm not sure about. We never have figured that out. But, he was comfortable there. The other part of that, you have to extend this one step farther on the comfort part. If a person's comfortable there, what it tells me is that, one, he's probably been there before. Perhaps he lived in this apartment house at some point. And the other part of that that's really important is if, let's say, law enforcement were to show up and he found out about that, then he could get out of her place, out the back door, down the alley, take a right, at the dumpster, take a left down the other alley, and he would know the methods of escape out of there better than anybody else would know. Yeah, and he had done it before. Okay, so there was a number of other factors involved, but I gave them a profile. I said, okay, what you're dealing with here, I believe, is a young male that's somewhere between 20 and 25 years old. You have, he has all of these other characteristics, and I laid them out in the book. And this is the guy that you need to look for, if I'm right. But so they, I guess they, I'm not going to say they made a half-hearted effort, but they investigated the case. I'd call every week. I went back to my office. This is not my case. You know, they call me in, and I did my part, and I left. And so I would call and say, you know, anything new, any progress, anything happening? No, not yet. You know, I'm thinking, for heaven's sakes. Well, finally, I wound up transferring from Cedar Rapids into Omaha. I got on another squad. I got involved in other stuff and got on with my life. And, you know, you don't only have one case when you're in the FBI. you know, I had a lot of things going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was working on the drug task force, which gave me a lot more things going on. But I kind of lost track. I just stopped making phone calls. I never stopped wondering.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never stopped wondering for, I'm going to say 20 years. And I was sitting in my office. At this point, I'd gone on and I had retired from Grand Junction, Colorado, and had a job as a department chair and associate professor at Pikes Peak Community College in Colorado Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting in my office one afternoon getting ready for class. And the phone rings, and I answer it, as I usually do. This is Pete. And it was a young lady on the other end of the phone. She said, is this Peter Klismet? I said, yeah. And she said, is it the same Peter Klismet who used to be an FBI agent in Omaha? And division, yeah. And then I'm thinking, oh, my God, well, you know, what in the world? She told me she was from the Omaha World Herald. And she said,
mm-hmm.
do you remember the Helen Wilson case? And it took me a second because it's, you know, at that point it had been 25 years.
It's been so long.
A long
right.
time. And she said, are you aware that this case has been solved, but that six people went to prison in Nebraska? They were all innocent, and I don't mean not guilty. I mean flat innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And they all went to the state prison in Nebraska, serving an aggregate total of over 70 years in prison for a crime they didn't commit and a crime they couldn't have committed. Now, that
oh
was the
God.
Level of that was the level of incompetence that. So we were dealing with there.
Can I interrupt you for a second? So what exactly happened? They ignored your profile, and they went and arrested other people based on what? I mean, what was the big mistakes that they made?
Oh, my God. I couldn't even start. We don't have enough time. but it's
top three.
Okay, the top three would be they got their initial information from a girl who was 17, had some mental health issues herself, serious issues,
mm-hmm.
and who said she was outside the scene of the crime that night when it happened. But if she was, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and she was 11 years old. It was 7 degrees below zero. You've got
you
to
sure
be a little... Yeah, you've got to be a little skeptical about that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
That was just for starters. The second mistake they made is by not looking at least looking at people who they may have talked to already that may have come close to the profile that
mm-hmm.
was done. They didn't do that. The third mistake they made was getting a totally incompetent, unqualified hog farmer, believe this, a hog farmer who had previously been a deputy for a year or so, and let him run the entire investigation.
Oh, dear.
It was unbelievable. He browbeat people into confessing to something that they didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And people will say, well, how did he do that? Or how did they do that? Or I would never admit to a crime. Well, he's not dealing
mm-hmm.
with people, you know, that are on the dean's list or Phi Beta Kappa's.
Exactly.
You know, in fact, one guy told him, said that, well, I dreamed about this. And if I dreamed about it, I must have done it. There's no way they could have done it. There's no way any more than one person could have done it.
And this guy said, okay, you're it then.
Yeah, there's money inside of sitting out in plain view, $1,400. If there were two people inside, somebody would have taken that money.
Oh, absolutely.
There's, you know, there's a real combination of things that these guys formed a theory and then discluded any other information that didn't fit into their theory that it was these six people. And, I mean, it would have looked like a herd of wildebeests had been in that small apartment. Six, I don't know if you six fit in the apartment. And like you say, I was on a submarine. I wouldn't want to be one of the six in there because it was it would have been pretty cramped. But in any event, it's been called, and I think is, the biggest travesty of justice and in the history of Western law enforcement, maybe in the history of the United States. Six people.
And so what did did they find the person who did it, and did that person fit your profile?
They indeed found the person. They did some DNA testing. Now, this was back in 1985, mind you, and DNA at that point was barely on the landscape, you know, just barely over the horizon. And so they identified one guy. He had died of AIDS. He was been living down in Oklahoma. He would come up and live in Beatrice for a while and then go back. And he was there when this killing occurred. And guess what? The profile said he was said be 20 to 25 years old. Bruce Smith was 22. And it went on and on and on. I mean, there's a whole litany of things that, and I'm not saying I'm the greatest thing in the world, but I hit almost everything right on the head. And they didn't pay attention. You know, if you're going to investigate a case, if you're going to pick up a cold case that's 4 years old, then you're going to look back at the file and find out, okay, what's been done so we don't have to redone it. And they didn't do that. The guy that was in charge of the investigation had absolutely no idea what he was doing. So as a consequence of that, as a consequence, the six people that were convicted filed lawsuits once they were let out of prison, filed lawsuits against the state and against basically everybody but me, I think. But that they just settled here several months ago for $27 million.
Oh, whoa. Well, good for them. They deserve it. They deserve every penny because that was outlandish and just horrid what
it
this
is.
Police department did to those innocent people. And what about the hog farmer slash deputy? What's he doing now?
You may or may not believe this.
I'm afraid to ask, actually. Afraid to hear.
You know the answer. He's still working there.
Oh, my God.
I heard Bert Searcy is still working there for the Sheriff's Department. And he cost them
$27
million. All he had to do
was
look back at the file several pages, and if he had looked at the profile, that would have told him exactly who he was looking for. As it turns out, I mean, I can, you know, that's kind of like having rear-view glasses on, I suppose. But,
sure.
But in any event, not doing that cost that county $27 million, and the county has no other option. It's a small county in Nebraska. They're going to go bankrupt.
And it costs those men many, many years of their lives for something they absolutely did not do. Peter Klismet, we're going to leave it on that. I want everybody to pick up your books because they are absolutely fascinating. You have FBI Diary, Profiles of Evil, which we just spoke about, one of the cases, and then FBI Diary, Homegrown Terror, which we talked about at the very beginning of the book, of the show. And you've got to get that book to hear the ending because we didn't tell you the ending because it's very dramatic and very exciting. And it's just, it was a wild, crazy police chase. And these guys disappeared into the desert. And if you get to FBI Diary, Homegrown Terror, you'll find out all about that. Peter Klismet, we're going to have you back on again as soon as you can talk about Dylan, maybe before, okay?
We will do that, and I'll let you know, Tricia, when that opportunity arises, or you know, one way or another, we'll stay in touch.
We will stay in touch because whether you like it or not, now you are going to be one of my regulars, so just kind of accept that fact, deal with it, and you'll be on very soon, okay?
Okay, that sounds good.
Thank you.
Peter, all right, Clinton, thanks,
everybody.
Tricia.
Thank you. Former FBI profiler and all-around really good law enforcement guy. Very smart. Has done a lot of work, you know, while he was with the FBI and when he retired. He's still working. He's still doing the job. Okay. We're going to move on now to another case. And this case is very troubling. I just heard a story recently that that the people that make antifreeze now are not going to make it sweet because that's the problem. You can drink antifreeze. You're like, oh, this is a lovely, refreshing beverage. No, it's antifreeze, and it will burn your guts out. That's why when dogs see it, they lick it, and they end up dying a horrible death. So I heard it on the radio, somebody talking that now – the antifreeze is going to be made to taste bitter and awful, which it should. It should never have been made to taste wonderful. And unfortunately, a wonderful, lovely woman, an attorney in Las Vegas, Susan Winters, she married this man named Dr. Brent Dennis. He was a psychologist. And on the morning of January 3rd, 2015, Susan Winters' family, I believe it was her parents, received a phone call from this Brent Dennis, the psychologist, saying Susan had drank antifreeze and wasn't expected to make it. And he said, oh, she killed herself. Now, let me tell you something. You might as well drink Clorox bleach or shove Comet down your throat, because drinking antifreeze is the most horrible way to go. If you're going to kill yourself, especially women, you're not going to drink antifreeze. I got an email from Susan Winters' niece, Taylor Winters, and I'm going to totally butcher this last name, and I do apologize, Taylor Winters Amil. And she asked if Web Sleuths would be interested in this case, and I said, are you kidding me? Of course we would be. Oh, it looks like Taylor has dropped. Bessie, can you get her back for me, please? Anyway, she said, our family is just, we've gone through this crazy ride. And so I looked up a little bit more about the case. Now, finally, they got the death certificate changed from suicide to undetermined. And that was a big, big deal. We have her back on the phone now. Taylor, let me get her right here. Taylor, are you there? Can you hear me? Taylor. I don't think she can hear me. Taylor, oh, I think she's dropped again. Yeah. Do you want to try one more time, Bessie, and see if you can get her on the phone? Okay, we'll do it here. We'll get it. We'll make it happen. Anyway, they finally got the death certificate changed to undetermined, which was a big deal. And believe me, that is a huge ordeal to try and get a death certificate, manner of death changed. It's rare that it happened. And I was just looking up this Dr. Dennis, Dr. Brent Dennis, and come to find out he's allowed to practice. Now, that was the last thing I read, and Taylor sent me an email saying that they had some good news, so I'm hoping the good news is that Dr. Dennis, the psychologist, is not able to practice anymore because apparently he's going to be charged with murder. Yeah. Susan Winters did not just decide to commit suicide and drink antifreeze. No, that didn't happen. Her husband, who was just an oddball, somehow gave it to her. Anyway, Tyler Winters is trying to get some publicity, some media for this bizarre case. And I'm thinking this case has, has all the big shows written all around it. Dateline, 48 Hours, Web Sleuths Radio, the biggest, of course. Hey, Bessie, what's the deal? Do you know? Did I give you the wrong number?
I believe you did. I've tried three times,
uh-oh,
and I'm getting Yeah, I'm getting a voicemail for somebody with a totally different name, and the voicemail box is full.
Let me check my sources here. But while we're doing that, we're talking about Susan Winter's drinking antifreeze. And, I mean, do you think anybody would actually drink antifreeze to commit suicide? I don't. Do you?
It's hard to believe. No, I would have to say no.
I've heard some very strange things. I remember a pathologist telling me that there was a guy that committed suicide by pen, and by stabbing him. And the family, of course, thought for sure he was murdered. And the doctor said no. It was Sarah Weck. Dr. Sarah Weck said no. He was not murdered. He committed suicide. So, okay, I am sending you the number. Let me see if it was the same one I sent you before. Boy, this is lovely. I think it's the same one I sent you before.
That's it.
Okay,
that's
hold on.
One.
You know what? I've talked to her. Hold on one second, everybody. Hey, Bessie, tell us how PolitEvent is going. That's our new
Wait. You just sent me a different number. Let me try that.
I did?
Yeah, one of the numbers was transposed. Let me try
that. Oh, okay. That's got to be it then. Sorry. Give that one a try. Anyway, I was going to have Bessie talk about PolitEvent, which is a new forum we started for political discussion, which isn't really monitored or moderated, and it's frightening. It's very frightening to go in there. It's scary. Everybody's talking about politics, but we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Susan Winters and whether she actually did commit suicide drinking antifreeze. She was a lawyer in Las Vegas, and her family is really trying to get a hold of her, or trying to get a hold of media to give some sort of press to this case, because how many times have we heard about, this is just Dateline material all over the place. It really is. It's perfect. So anyway, let's see if this is Susan right here. Not Susan, excuse me, Taylor. Taylor, are you there? Taylor? Hello? I don't think that was, I can't believe we can't get a hold of them. Oh my gosh. Okay, hold on, everybody. We're going to send a quick email right now to them. Okay, urgent. Call in at, let me get that phone number. We will edit this out of the live, of the recorded version, of course. So, anyway, hold on. Let me get that to her, and then we will see. Bessie, can you come back on for me, please? Are you trying again? Okay. She's going to try again. Okay. Let's see if that works. Okay, let me see if that's working. La-di-da. I would sing, but speaking of drinking antifreeze, that's kind of how you'll feel if you listen to my singing. It is not anything.
Okay.
Hi.
Here's Taylor. Hang on one sec.
Okay.
Taylor?
Yes.
Oh,
okay,
there she is. Yay. Taylor, sorry. I transposed a number, and I had to babble like an idiot until we were able to get you on the phone. I do apologize for the wait.
You're
I was just going through what the email that you sent me about your Aunt Susan. So let's start. I just want to hear it first. Tell me a little bit about your Aunt Susan before we get to the marriage and the supposed suicide. Tell us about the woman, Susan Winters.
She was wonderful. She was vibrant and brilliant beyond measure, really. She graduated law school at OU, which is University of Oklahoma in Norman. And she moved out to Las Vegas upon graduating. She took a job ironically, at the district attorney's office, and then worked there for a number of years, and then went to a private practice. But she was just vibrant, like I said, and so full of life. She was a triathlete and a marathon runner.
Mm-hmm.
And she was always, she loved Starsky and Hutch. She was a huge Elvis fan. I mean, loved Elvis. And
so, and she was a successful attorney in Las Vegas, right?
Yes, she was highly successful. She actually won a case, and subsequently, because she won the case, it created a bill, like a law, and that was when she was first starting out, so that kind of paved the way and got her known, and then she became a judge. She sat for a friend. She was a part-time judge out there before returning to work as an attorney. She was a judge while she was raising her kids, but she was just so full of life, and she always had a witty comeback and was always making people laugh. I mean, she loved sugar cookie dough, as crazy as that sounds. Like, during Christmas, we'd always make cookies, and she would always want to eat the raw dough.
Oh, well, see.
And,
that,
I mean, she was...
Can't do that anymore.
No.
You can't eat raw dough anymore.
But,
they say it makes you sick, but anyway.
Exactly. But she loved dogs. She loved all animals. You couldn't even say dogs around her. They were babies.
So what you're telling us, Taylor, is that your aunt, Susan Winters, was not a depressed person.
No.
She wasn't going to kill herself. Let's move forward, shall we? Susan
yes.
Winters meets and marries Dr. Brent Dennis. Tell us about that union. Give us your ideas and kind of the impression maybe her parents had and what the family thought of this guy.
He was like sandpaper. He just rubbed you the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And we all tried to like him just, you know, because she was a daughter, our sister, our aunt, you know, and they were married. They were married for a number of years. We tried to like him, and we did like him. You know, we really had no qualms with him, just how he just had to be the smartest person in the room. He was very arrogant at times, and I mean, he was a doctor. He had his PhD. He had every reason to be. But their marriage at times could be rocky, but they were also very fun-loving and would laugh and joke around, and we all would go out there for Thanksgiving, and it was difficult because he would make inappropriate comments, and he was very egotistical, but...
Like
she
what? Give us an example so we can get a feel for this guy.
I was 12 years old, and he asked me if I had my lady bits pierced. Yes.
Oh my God! Did your Aunt Susan know this?
Yes. He asked me that in front of my grandparents, my parents, and we're talking below.
Oh. God.
Yes.
What did everybody do?
The room got very silent, and just it was appalling and disgusting. We really didn't know how to handle that or what to say. I mean, what
right.
do you say to that type of question?
Mm-hmm.
Just he would always, you know, ooh, come on, Susan, shake it for me, baby. In front of her parents and, you know, just things that you don't announce in public.
Right.
Or in front of your parents. I mean, that was just just time and place. And, he was just he would make jokes about how he could do drugs recreationally, but he could never become addicted because he was smarter than that.
And let me stop you right there. Because this is part of the problem. Okay, give us the year and kind of what led up to that phone call that I believe your grandparents received about Susan? Was there trouble in the marriage? Was there anything going on? So what year was this when this happened?
It was 2015, January 3rd, when we received the phone call. My grandparents did. That was Susan was
okay. And before that, were there any warning signs? Anything that sticks out?
Not to us, because they had just flown back to Vegas from being with us during Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was fine. It was great. We were laughing and, you know, good time had by all. But the only thing that set it off was the fact that she was going to leave him. And if she left him, he had everything to lose because she had the money. And she was his lifeline. If she left, mm-hmm. divorced him, she took the money and he had nothing. He was living off of her.
Oh, boy.
And
so
right,
you knew she was going to get divorced? Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
A text message. She had text messages to her friends saying, I'm leaving Brent. I'm going to expose his cocaine problem. I'm going to the board of psychology. I'm contacting his drug dealer, and I want out. And by threatened to expose him, the only way to keep him afloat was for her to be gone.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
but
so
no,
that we've
was,
got.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say. So here we have just this blatant, almost made-for-TV motive here of this guy, and it's just amazing how he tries to deny everything. But okay, please continue.
She had basically said in a text message, and they had printed it in one of the articles that had. Like I said,
mm-hmm.
told her friends, I think Brent's cheating on me. I know he has a drug problem. I've contacted his drug dealer. I'm going to expose him for everything. And, you know, I want to leave him. I want a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And by her doing that, it set a train of motion in his mind that if she's doing this, I lose my job. I lose the money. I lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that obviously he's like I said,
yeah,
this motive is just
tons,
so bad.
I mean, if her dying and it being a suicide or whatever he could play off, he stood to inherit roughly $2 million and $1 million life insurance policy.
This just gets worse and worse. So let's talk about the night that your grandparents got that phone call in 2015, January. Tell us about
it. It was 7:00 Vegas time, so it was 9 in the morning here. And he had called my grandpa and said, my God, Dan, she drank antifreeze. Susan's at the hospital, and she's not going to make it. And then my mother called me and said, Susan's passed.
Oh,
and I
dear.
Said, what did he do to her?
Mm-hmm.
And when my dad got wind of the story, whenever, you know, we were all called to my grandparents' house, he said the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
What did he do to her?
It was just automatic.
Because it was. It definitely was. Just because she, my grandpa's birthday was January 7th. She had bought a plane ticket to come back home to celebrate his birthday.
Right.
You know, she had written out the card. Sadly enough, that my grandfather had to open on his birthday without her there, and it said, "I love you so much. You're the best daddy in the world." And so
yeah,
there
was. Yeah, doesn't sound like someone who's suicidal.
No, she had bought her and her youngest daughter, Danny, plane tickets to mm-hmm. Hawaii for their cheer competition. She had things set in place that just don't add up. If you look at mm-hmm. everything surrounding it, it wasn't like she had written a note or said anything of, I'm doing this. You know, it was, I'll see you again. I can't wait to be home for Daddy's birthday. There were just little things like that. But, there wasn't any indication that she was depressed. If anything, she was in her prime,
mm-hmm.
to be honest. I mean, she'd gotten a job again as an attorney. She was back on her feet, and she was loving life. She was killing it, basically.
Right. She just, yeah, just doing it.
Yeah, just doing her thing. And, you know, her girls were older. Allie, her oldest, she was going to drive. They had talked about looking at colleges later on.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about taking more family trips. We had just gotten back from a two-week vacation in June, that summer before, in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking about, we were in Scotland and Ireland, and we were, we were just... Right. There were good things
going on. It all pointed to her being a happy person. So,
yes,
supposedly
ma'am.
She drinks, your Aunt Susan drinks this antifreeze, which we know she didn't. Her husband calls your grandparents and said, yeah, she committed suicide. She drank antifreeze. Can you believe that? What happens next with the investigation?
Police officers show up at his door that morning. He says, you know, because they called 911. He called 911
mm-hmm.
and said, and before he even, you know, was asked what was going on, the 911 call was, my wife killed herself. She drank antifreeze.
Mm.
And so that's how he prefaces the whole investigation. And from then, Detective Rhonda Borgia makes no investigation, and she has now been fired because of her lack of investigation.
Really? Oh, now that is absolutely very uplifting news, because that rarely happens.
Yes.
So detective who just went, okay, committed suicide, done. Fired because she didn't put in the effort that was needed. Okay, good. Keep going.
No, not at all. Then they rush her to the ER, and she's had, you know, renal failure. She's had two heart attacks, but her vitals were going up. She was becoming
mm-hmm.
stronger. But I guess there was a do not resuscitate or something, but she was getting stronger. Anywho, sorry, I have to take a minute. He pulled
Are you okay?
the plug. No, I'm good.
Okay.
I'm great.
Okay.
He pulls the plug and leaves the hospital while all of her friends are out in the waiting room and doesn't tell them at all. He just up and leaves.
That's awful.
No one knows. And no one's at the house. None of the investigators are at the house. And that was about 9 o'clock or so. So he's left with ample amount of time to clean up the crime scene and dispose of the antifreeze bottles.
Mm-hmm.
And just get rid of everything. And then at 2:45, one of her friends asked the doctor, where is Susan? And they said, oh, she's already in the morgue. He hadn't told them anything. He hadn't done anything. My grandparents were chartering a private jet to get out there, and he said, don't worry
mm-hmm.
about it. Susan's already dead. You wouldn't have wanted to see her like that anyway.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't matter if you've been smashed by a bus. That's your child.
Right.
You want to see them.
I hear you. Right. I'm sorry. Continue.
He does that, and he goes about his day. Doesn't tell anybody. what had gone on. And finally, you know, it was basically forced out of him what had happened once everybody had gotten a hold of Brent and asked, you know, hey, what's up? Why is Susan, you know, where is Susan? Why is she dead? We thought she was recovering. We thought her vitals were going up. You know, despite everything, we thought she was going to recover. And he just pulled the plug and didn't say anything and went on. And that was Saturday. And by that evening, me, my mom, my dad, and my grandparents were in Vegas demanding answers and what had happened. And not accusing him of anything, going out there to support him, to support, you know, my cousins, my grandparents, his two other granddaughters, and just kind of like,
let me just back up here for a moment, everybody. The Susan Winters case, Susan Winters was a Las Vegas attorney, and her husband, Dr. Brent Dennis, said she drank antifreeze to commit suicide. Her family knew that was a bunch of baloney. But the investigating officer said, you know what, yeah, she did commit suicide. Close the case. That was it. Fortunately, now that particular police detective has been fired due to her lack of ability to do any work whatsoever. And on the phone with us now, we have Susan Winters' niece, who wrote Web Sleuth and saying, help us get attention for this case, because it doesn't end there with just a suicide. There's a lot more going on. And we're talking with Taylor Winters, and I know I'm going to mess this last name up. Let me see if I can do it. Amrio. Is that it?
Jaramillo.
I told
you. Amrio.
Say it again.
Jaramillo.
Jaramillo. Okay,
Jaramillo.
Sorry about that.
You're
terrible
fine.
With last names. Anyway, Taylor, so now they've determined that it is suicide, and that's it. He doesn't care. He's moved on. He's got this life insurance policy. What do you do next to get some attention, to get that death certificate changed from suicide to anything but suicide?
You hire former FBI agent turned private investigator, and you have him follow
it.
And that's
and
what
my family did. Find? What did he find?
What didn't he find, really?
Okay. What didn't he find?
Drugs. He would always go to the New Orleans Hotel there in Vegas, which is a known drug dealer habitat, if you want to call it that, where he would meet with his drug dealer, Jeff Crosby. And he would always, before going to the New Orleans, he would withdraw cash in the ATM. He'd purchase something, and then he would bend down in his car for a minute, lift his face back up, wipe his nose, and drive on.
And that's terrible. But let me just play devil's advocate here. He does a lot of drugs. Obviously, he has a drug problem. Does that mean he killed her? How is there a connection?
In October, prior to Susan's death, there was a $180,000 check stolen out of Susan's bank account. That was signed by Susan in Brent's handwriting, made out to Brent.
Oh, brother.
Right. He was. And that's the problem. There's all this circumstantial evidence, but no smoking gun. But what's pretty gross about all of this is we were at the funeral home, and he turned around and looked at me, my mom, my dad, my grandparents, and said, wow, I didn't think funerals cost this much, and then proceeded to hand them Susan's credit card to pay for her own funeral.
Oh, now that is low. That's really low. Oh, God. So, but how did you get the death certificate changed? I mean, that's so hard to do. People don't realize it's almost impossible. So you have an FBI agent, former FBI agent, following this guy. We know he buys drugs. He's just your general all-around scumbag. How did that all come together to where you could get it changed?
We hired attorney Anthony Scro out in Vegas, and he and his partner David Rogers, former district attorney out there, worked relentlessly to find things and connect the dots and just try to piece together this puzzle for us. And once they had enough of what they thought was good, solid evidence, they took it before the Henderson Police Department and asked them, hey, there's just a lot of inconsistencies with this. Would you please look, you know, relook into this? And once Henderson Police looked into it again and took a closer look, they came to the coroner and said, you know, we fired our detective. Maybe you need to look at this again. Maybe you have it wrong.
Good for them. Finally.
Honestly, it was by the grace of God.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were a lot of sleepless nights for my grandparents of, you know, you can't, if the coroner doesn't change it, we have nothing. We can't, you know, they're not buying this. They're not realizing, you know, that because Brent just kept saying, this isn't how normal people mourn.
Mm-hmm.
You're just angry. This isn't, you know, this isn't right. This isn't how you mourn. And, but once the coroner took a look at the evidence again and talked to the doctors, he went out and actually did legwork and, you know, tracked down the doctors who had worked on Susan and realized that he had her cremated, so there couldn't have been another autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
Just going through and looking, and really, once they got the manner of death changed and cause of death to undetermined, that was, we felt like it was a win. But other than that, it was really by the grace of God, because if the police wouldn't have reopened the case, none of that would have happened. And that was what the coroner said. I will not change my mind unless this case gets reopened. And we actually, in February of 15, we flew out to Vegas, all of us, and met with the coroner. And he said, no, I'm right. This isn't, you know, you are wrong. Unless the police open it, case closed, boom, done. And once it got reopened, he took another look at the evidence, and we were able to move forward.
And why didn't he put it as murder,
really,
do you know? Instead of undetermined, why
Brent
didn't he
said
use...
it was a suicide.
Ah.
Because there wasn't...
So it was...
It was covering his behind.
Mm-hmm.
Because
got it.
He had to go back on his initial decision.
Right. So
he had to go back on his initial decision and changed it.
Which
and
he
that
would
have
been...
looked very bad.
Right, exactly. Has Brent been arrested?
He was arrested February 2nd of 2017 with an open murder charge. And they put his bail at $250,000, and I think he had to post 15% of that or 10%. And he posted bail, and he's free.
And is he practicing? Last I read, he was practicing. He's a psychologist.
He is a psychologist, but he his license has been suspended.
Oh, good.
And
they
will relook at it in November to see if he can have his license reinstated.
Mm-hmm.
But on Friday, our attorneys talked to the DA, and the Supreme Court had said that he no longer can have his funds or Susan's funds because he is using her life insurance money to pay his attorneys and basically keep him out of jail with her money.
That is amazing. I was just going to ask, what happened? Did he get the insurance money? He did, but now he's not allowed to spend it? Is that what you're saying?
No, they no, because earlier in 2016, well, not even, yeah, in late 2016, right before he got charged with open murder, they had frozen all of his assets.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wasn't, and he was no longer able to practice, but his assets didn't involve, I'm assuming, the life insurance money because that was Susan's.
Mm-hmm.
Or he had that, like, kind of swirled away where they couldn't find it. But once they took it before the judge, and mind you, this all started out as a civil trial.
Mm-hmm.
The murder trial was not brought on until the DA got involved and was basically like, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is, you know, this needs to be bigger than what it is. But
right.
And then with the civil trial, Brent's attorneys were trying to say that's not fair to my client because he, if he says anything in a civil trial, that's implicating himself in a murder trial. You know, we just need to have this whole thing thrown out. It's a big misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
and
as of yesterday, as of Friday, the Supreme Court went back and talked to the judge and was like, you didn't even look at the evidence. This is crazy. He shouldn't have any money at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they have now seized everything. And then the Board of Psychology said that even though there's all this evidence, it doesn't exactly implicate him in a murder, in a murder. Or it,
mm-hmm.
Because he hasn't been charged in murder, we can still allow him to practice. But they are suspending it until November, and then they will have a new hearing in November.
To see. Okay. Well, that's,
see,
I was,
yes.
Because last I heard he was practicing. I'm like, no, he can't have any patients.
But,
please tell me.
Right. But just kind of going on and sleuthing on Facebook after everything that happened, whenever he'd gotten arrested, he had talked about the death of his wife to his patients.
Mm-hmm.
And just...
that's weird.
Right. Right. And he had...
Did they come forward?
They have not come forward, or that
okay.
I know of. But he had hired a doctor in his practice a couple months prior to the murder because he wasn't able to write prescriptions.
Mm-hmm.
So he hired another doctor who could write prescriptions and fired him shortly after Susan's death. And that is where the oxycodone came from.
Oh, okay.
Because Susan wasn't prescribed to it.
Mm-hmm.
That was my question.
Interesting.
This is Dessie Taylor. If I could just ask a couple of questions.
Of course.
So she did have oxycodone in her system then before, along with the antifreeze. Correct?
Yes. And according to the coroner's report, the oxycodone in her system was very, very small. It couldn't.
Right.
That wasn't the main cause of death.
Cause of death. Do you have any idea, just to... a wild idea or a guess of how he would have gotten her to ingest the antifreeze?
The antifreeze actually, because I don't know if you know this, but it used to be sweet. And it
yeah,
was,
I do know that. So could he have
right.
put it in a drink and disguised
yes.
it as a cocktail?
He had, right. What we believe is that he had made a statement that they were drinking all night and celebrating the new year. Well, there was no alcohol found in her system. There wasn't anything. So what we believe, and we believe that he put it in her Diet Coke. She loved Diet Coke. And was just giving it to her in slow amounts throughout the day.
Right. Gotcha. Wow.
And, yes. And while he had said that she had ingested it, he had no, and this is where his statement gets kind of contradictory. He says that he didn't know what she took or what she had done. But then he goes on to say, well, I happened to see a search for antifreeze poisoning on the computer.
At this
time, that was about midnight or so. Well, at that time, Susan was incapacitated, according to the doctor's statement of how the antifreeze affected her body, and she would have not been able to do that.
Right. Wow.
Yes. And he had done these searches prior to January 3rd while he was at work. And he had a program installed on his computer to make it look like it was coming from their home computer.
Mm-hmm.
So to make it look like Susan had done it, but it was traced back to his work.
Huh. So he thought he had thought of everything.
Right. He thought he covered his tracks, but he had not.
Yeah. What a creep. I mean, just the inappropriate behavior that you described. I mean, that's not something that, you would say, oh, this guy's a murderer. But
no. And there's not anything, unfortunately, there's not a smoking gun. There's just a lot of little things that, while he says in his, he's telling all of us that, and even in his deposition, that he was home all night and he was snuggled up next to her. Well, going back and looking at all the evidence, he's making phone calls at midnight, 1 in the morning, 2:15, 3:15. He's driving to the New Orleans hotel, and because his cell phone's pinging off the different towers that are not at his
home,
are in route. So, I mean, he's, and what we believe is that he's going and buying more drugs and ingesting in himself, maybe giving them to her. But, and then he, right before he calls 911 January 3rd, cell phone records show that he calls the doctor who had prescribed the pain pills and his drug dealer. Immediately after dialing 911, he calls those same people. He's contacting them while he's in the hospital with Susan. Right.
And when you look at that, that's
when it makes it.
Sure. And when you said he pulled the plug, I mean, he physically himself pulled the plug?
No, I'm so sorry. He had doctors do that.
Despite
her showing signs of improvement and
the
wishes of us saying, hey, even if she's not making it, at least let us see her one more time.
Yeah, give her a chance, sure.
Right.
But he ordered the... Oh, God.
Right.
It's just
awful. And this
awful.
Is a woman
is
who was...
She
was a marathon runner. Her vital signs were improving.
Yeah, yeah. So she wasn't brain dead and,
No.
That's awful. To me, it's just so obvious.
He was writing prescriptions for his patients and then buying them back from them. He goes on record in his deposition saying that he is doing these drugs while he's still practicing before patients come in to see him. And that's just the gross behavior that's disturbing us, where, yes, that makes him a bad guy. you know, that just,
that's
where we're upset, just like, hey, how could you still allow this man to practice while he's, you know, literally saying, I don't have a drug of choice. I like them all.
I do drugs
before taking patients.
Okay. Taylor, let me ask you really quickly. What did your Aunt Susan see in this guy?
Her high school sweetheart.
There you go. Okay.
And he probably wasn't that bad, you know, at first.
In the beginning.
No, he, actually grew up with my dad.
Uh-huh.
My dad and him, they went to high school together. They played football, baseball, and they were around. And I think, you know, she was a couple years younger than he was, but I remember her saying, I knew I loved Brent the moment I saw him. I thought he was great. And she would have walked through fire for him.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's just tragic. So where do we stand today, Taylor? What are we waiting on? Is there a trial date? What's the latest?
Hopefully, from the conversation we had on Friday with our attorneys and the district attorney, there is in September, they are scheduled to go before the grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that'll kind of be the, not pre-trial, but just, you know, practice run, I guess. And if...
Right.
And then hopefully they said we could do...
You'll kind of find out how much evidence
you know.
They have.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And they, you know, if the grand jury chooses to indict and they move forward, hopefully by February of 2018, we will be in trial for her murder.
Oh, let's hope.
That's going to be tough for all of you. I wish you would just plead guilty and say, you know, spare the family.
Right. But he's not the type of guy to think about anybody else but him.
No.
Bessie, do you have any other questions?
No, I think that's it. I mean, it just seems so cut and dry to me. Of course, I don't know, you know, all of the facts, but Taylor's provided quite a few of them that you know, absolutely make it, to me, very obvious.
Thank you, Taylor.
That is guilty.
And plus, Taylor's on Web Sleuth, and so we do have a thread going about your aunt. And I'm hoping you'll join there and answer our members' questions. And so Dateline or 48 Hours, nobody has contacted you about this case yet?
My family spoke with ABC earlier this year, and they met and spoke. But there really hasn't been a huge push of getting things out there. And I feel that's what needs to happen, is just to have her case known so people understand. And if not for us and not our family, just so that he's not practicing while doing drugs and trying to shape the lives of other patients while he's under the influence.
Okay. That is a very good point. And a lot of the producers from all of those shows read at Web Sleuth. I'll make sure that they see this case and pass on your contact information, Taylor. And to me, this just has Dateline written all over it. It really does. I mean, this is just perfect for them.
I mean, and once you get down in the heart of everything, it is such a convoluted and tangled case that is, unfortunately for our family, fascinating to other people whenever they hear about it and understand it.
Sure.
It definitely has everything.
Mm-hmm.
It does. And it's not what you want, but it's just the truth. That's just how it is. It's
you're exactly
right. It does. And as tragic as it is, people are into true crime, as we all know, at Web Sleuth. They want to hear the story. They want to hear the facts. And
I'm sorry, go on.
No, you go. You took a class in college in what?
Oh, no, I was saying I took a class in college, and unfortunately the first thing my professor told us was, if it bleeds, it leaves.
There you go.
And
that's true.
And it definitely has everything.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I do think you will be getting the publicity you need to stop this man from at the very least practicing, like you said, while he's using drugs and has a suspicion of murder hanging over his head, not
mm-hmm.
somebody you'd want to go to, basically, to help with your life problems. Taylor, we'll be in touch. Be sure and jump on Web Sleuths. We will help you any way we can. You'll find a very large group of people there just kind of reaching out and giving you a big cyber hug. They'll make you feel good even if they can't physically do anything, but just know you have thousands of people from all over the world right there listening to you and giving you support. So I will send you the link to your aunt's thread. I'll also put it in the main box on the front page of websleuths.com so everybody can go to that. And Taylor, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us and give our best to your grandparents and all of Susan's family. We're very sorry, and we'll help any way we can.
Well, thank you so much. Like I told you before, it just means the world to my family and I that you're taking the time to do this. So thank you.
Oh, we are happy to do it. Take care, and we'll be in touch, okay?
All right. Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Good luck.
Well, Miss Bessie, that is the show for today. Actually, when people hear it, they're going to have about 30 minutes taken out of me bumbling around because I gave you the wrong phone number for Taylor. Oh, how embarrassing.
Oh, that's...
anyway, but yeah, it'll be quite a bit shorter than what you heard today live. But Bessie, as always, thank you doing the heavy lifting behind the scenes. I really appreciate it. And everything going okay with you? Things good in Polit Event and life is good on Web Sleuths?
Everything's going pretty well, and Polit Event, of course, you know, goes on.
It certainly does. It can be very interesting.
It is. And I like the fact that
you're right there in the
heavily moderated. Yeah.
Right. You're in the heat of it, and it can be intense, but. But it's good. I invite everybody, if you need to vent about politics, that's why we have PolitEvent. So please go there. Bessie and I are the moderators, mostly Bessie, because she knows a lot more than I do about stuff. So, Bessie, thank you so much, my dear. We will see you next week, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Trisha. Have a good night.
Take care. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Everybody, that's it for Web Sleuths Radio, formerly known as Trisha's True Crime Radio. We'll be back next week with another fantastic, fabulous edition. And be sure and join us on websleuths.com, okay? Goodbye.